According to a recent industry report from Simba Information, article processing charges, so-called APCs, the fees that publishers collect from authors for making their work available under open access rules, are expected to grow 80% by 2017. Indeed, the report projects OA publishing revenues will rise at a pace far faster than traditional publishing. Clearly, open access is here to stay. And the disruption that OA has generated has publishers rethinking business models and turning to technology for solutions. Our experts today will share insights on open access as a business and what that means for scholarly publishers. You'll also hear how technology solutions are emerging to meet the open access challenge. And as Casey mentioned, we will take your questions. We do ask you to use that chat box in the lower right-hand corner of the screen. Let us know what's on your mind. If you have a particular question for one of the participants, please let us know who it's directed at. We will get to the questions at the end of the program. If you are tweeting the program today, and we will be doing that ourselves, our hashtag is, as always, CCC Open Access. You can follow Copyright Clearance Center on Twitter at Copyright Clear. So use that hashtag if indeed you are tweeting the program today. And joining me now is Joe Esposito. Joe is president of Process Media. And Joe, welcome to our program.
Very nice to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, we're happy to welcome you here. Joe Esposito is a management consultant working primarily in the world of digital media, software, and publishing. He is particularly focused on research publishing, especially with the migration to digital services from a print background. Prior to setting up his consulting business, Joe served as CEO of three companies, Encyclopedia Britannica, Tribal Voice, and SRI Consulting, and he has received grants from the Mellon, MacArthur, and Hewlett Foundations, all concerning research into new aspects of publishing. Of special interest to many of us today is the fact that Joe is the author of more than 200 posts to the Scholarly Kitchen blog. And Scholarly Kitchen blog, you should be following it if you're not already, covers what's hot and what's cooking in scholarly publishing. It's presented by the Society for Scholarly Publishing, SSP, as part of its mission to advance scholarly publishing and communication. The Scholarly Kitchen blog was established in February 2008 to keep members and others aware of new developments in publishing. And Joe, you are a frequent contributor, contributing today, not on the topic of open access, but on libraries. And we follow what you write very closely. And so one of your more recent posts, a pair of posts actually, looked at open access and kind of keyed in on that report that I briefly mentioned from Simba. And you talked about the size of the open access market in scholarly publishing and what its growth over the last 10 years or so and its maturation really means for today and for the future. So I wonder if you could recap some of the major points you made there. And our headline for this notion is From Woodstock to Wall Street. And by that, I guess what we mean is that open access more than 10 years ago really began as a revolutionary movement. But what we're seeing today is something quite different.
Well, that's certainly the case. Indeed, when you listen to some of the rhetoric surrounding open access, it almost sounds like the anti-Vietnam War protests from the 1960s. It's really kind of wild and over the top. And you then look at what we're really talking about, which is simply trying to provide access to some people who don't have library subscriptions for research material. What was interesting to me about the Simba report is that it took a very sober glance at the marketplace for open access material and began to summarize just how large that market is. In other words, open access now was being looked at with a cold, rational eye instead of the eye of the wild enthusiast or the advocate. It's a very, very big change in the tone of what is going on today.
Well, indeed, and we will talk about some of the particulars of that Simba report. And in your blog post, you mentioned that one of the things that's such a challenge when talking about the size of open access relative to the rest of scholarly publishing is part of it is hidden from view, and that makes looking at the economic impact and the economic models, the business models, that much more challenging.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. It's one thing to be able to trace the APCs, the author publishing charges that are going for gold open access, But how do you do a quantification, if any quantification is possible, for multiple copies of an article that might appear in institutional repositories, some of which may be authorized, some of which are not? So there's no real way of adding that up. For people who are in the business of publishing, of course, the market of open access is what's the key thing, not the many copies of open access articles that are out there. Most people in the business of publishing are concerned about those extra copies of open access articles, largely from the point of view that they may be cannibalizing subscription sales. But in fact, in terms of people coming up with competing businesses, it's really the gold open access publishers that are taking the lead here. And I'd like to point out that it's no longer the wild-eyed activists. Virtually every large journals publisher today has an open access program. And the phrase I use for that is that open access is now being domesticated by established publishers. It's no longer an activist's game.
Well, indeed. And the very largest of the OA publishers, of course, is Springer, which is the owner of BioMed Central.
Yeah, and you know, there is, in that CIMA report, there's a very interesting chart. It lists the top 10 open access publishers by revenue. And I didn't check all of them out, but I believe that 7 or 8 of them are commercial publishers and 2 are not-for-profits. So what we really have here is a situation where open access has gone from being, you know, as we say in the slide here, it's gone from being Woodstock, it's gone from being peace, love, and happiness into a business, as you'd expect it would. And by making it into a business, it now has some guarantee of sustainability because business people look at things and try to find where the demand is going to be and follow that demand. So I think that the irony here is that even as the passion has diminished and has been transmuted into a sober, rational, economic perspective, even as that has happened, it also, at the same time and paradoxically, is guaranteeing the future success of open access because people are seeing it as something that can generate profits.
Well, indeed, and you know, we have seen ourselves at Copyright Clearance Center just what you're talking about. At the Frankfurt Book Fair, we organized a town meeting and had on the stage with us representatives of the Nature Publishing Group, of Wiley, and other publishers. And as you pointed out, they have reorganized themselves around open access to deliver, you know, first of all, to publish open access journals, but to deliver services and to do some new and innovative things that really grow out of this open access evolution. And I think finally, before we get into some of the numbers, a point that you may want to just emphasize for the audience here is that as this market matures, what we're seeing is the business, as you say, this move from Woodstock to Wall Street, kind of coming to the fore. And so open access is going to be subject to many of the same economic principles as any business.
Yeah, exactly right. When the various funding agencies began to say that they would pay for gold open access, you'd have to be pretty slow not to pick up on the fact that this represents an entirely new market for publishing. It used to be that most of the revenues came downstream. Most of the revenues came from libraries. There were revenues outside of libraries, of course, such as, you know, hospitals, some individual subscribers, and so on. But what has happened now is you have a new customer, and the customer is now the author, and the author is having those bills paid by the sponsoring agency for his or her research. That's a new market. And this is really going to be an additive market for publishing in the future. It's really quite astonishing how quickly this has come about and how quickly this has been established as a bona fide business.
Right. Well, let's look at some numbers. And we are speaking right now with Joe Esposito of Process Media and a regular and much admired contributor to the Scholarly Kitchen blog from SSP. If you are online with us right now and tweeting the program, our Twitter hashtag is CCC Open Access. You can follow Copyright Clearance Center at Copyright Clear. If you have a question for Joe, use the chat box in the lower right-hand corner of the screen and let us know what's on your mind. So we do have some numbers which are quoted here from that CIMBA report looking at open access journal publishing over the next 3 years. And some of the points we've already started to speak to, which is really coming up with a number for open access within the STM journals marketplace is a challenge itself. But what is the number and what does it mean that it's 2.3%, Joe?
Well, first you have to think about what's the 100%. And the figure you typically hear is a figure in the range of $10 to $10.5 billion for total revenues for journal sales. So what we saw from that Simba report is they went out and they did an assessment of everybody who was, in fact, making money with open access, and they discovered that the total figure came to 2.3% of that total. Now, what I guess I would say to you is that 2.3% is, on one hand, it's a small number, and if you're looking at the slide right now, you see that, that tiny orange slice, which is the open access portion of this much bigger pie. On the other hand, who wants to walk away from 2.3% of the revenue? And furthermore, it's the section of the marketplace that's growing most rapidly. It is important.
Well, right. I'm sorry, Joe, but just because you are somebody who really does look at the impact of the digital transition in publishing, and as you point out, it's not just the 2.3%, and so therefore not important, but what is important is just how quickly this has grown. We're looking at a startup business that didn't exist only a few years ago.
Yeah, that's it exactly. It's growing very, very rapidly from a very small base. And I would say, and not everybody would agree with me, I would say the 2.3% is pretty significant. You talk to any publisher and say, we're going to cut your sales by 2.3%, and you're going to hear howls. 2.3% is very attractive, and that figure is going to grow beyond 4% in a very short period of time. That all, again, is in that report we've been citing. It is important to note that these figures are exclusively for gold open access, the so-called author pays model, because there is, as far as we can determine, no revenue attached to green open access. But I personally see this, as a very, very significant thing that we have this beachhead of open access revenue in the overall publishing market.
Right. The other thing that has been measured by Simba on our next slide is a look at the volume of open access articles relative to the total number published in a single year, which they peg at 2 million. What's the relevance of this figure here?
Well, first we should note that this figure has been corroborated by a librarian named Walt Crawford as well, and he independently came up with the same figures. The assumption right now is that there are about 2 million peer-reviewed research articles published every year, a figure that seems to be growing by a rate of between 3 and 4% a year. Right now, about 20% of those articles are being published in open access format, which gives us 20% or 400,000 articles. That's a very, very big number. So on one hand, we've got 2.3% of revenue being open access, but we have 20% of the articles being open access.
Well, indeed. And, you know, we were speaking about the leading open access publishers. You mentioned that Springer is number one. I believe Simba placed the Public Library of Science, PLOS as it's known, at number two. And what's interesting here, again, it's the story of the startup. The success of the startup here is that PLOS really has altered this marketplace by its own existence. It really changed what we think about a journal.
PLOS is a revolutionary organization, and their leading service, which is PLOS One, is really the product out there that is transforming the way people are thinking about open access and how it can work as a business. What PLOS One has done is really, first of all, it has made open access profitable, but it's also introduced a number of things, a whole new notion of what peer review should be, for example. And PLOS One is being copied by one publisher after another. So it truly is a seminal organization in the publishing space.
Right. And there are some more numbers to look at here. We are speaking, as I mentioned, with Joe Esposito, taking a kind of a really sharp eye at a report from the Simba Information Group looking at the open access market. And so, Joe, you alluded to this before. There's a question what this all will mean in the future. When we've got these numbers of 2.3% of a total market in dollars and 20% when measured in articles. And the question that you raised in a follow-up post to the original post for Scholarly Kitchen was to ask the question, was this going to be additive, substitutive, or subtractive? And you've got a prediction, but tell us what those other terms mean, additive and substitutive, as well as subtractive.
Well, if we have a 10.5 journals business out there and we say that open access is going to be additive, what that means is that the market is going to be bigger than $10.5 billion, whatever that number happens to be. If we say it's subtractive, what we're saying is what many open access advocates are saying, and that is that open access is going to essentially be a substitute for toll access publications. So then that $10.5 billion number will start to come down. And if we say it's simply substitutive, that is to say open access is going to have the same kind of revenues attached to it as toll access publications do, then we continue to have a $10.5 billion market that's growing in the low single digits every year. But that's the point of those terms. I think that if you are the head of a publishing organization, what you're most likely to be contemplating is the big gap between the 2.3% of revenue earned by open access publications and the 20% of volume. Now, that's a big gap. It's almost a 10 times gap. And you have to begin asking yourself, are these figures going to converge? Will at some point the pricing and the market share as measured in the number of articles become much more closely aligned? And what will that mean then for my organization in the future?
Well, your own prediction is actually not new to anyone who follows you, because you said much the same about 10 years ago. You really believe that it's going to be additive, and it really is growing out of this notion of OA as a business in scholarly publishing. And you use an analogy that we'll all be familiar with right now, because as we watch the price of a gallon of gas, or a liter, I suppose, outside the U.S., fall rather significantly. But the point about the oil market is it's not what's in the ground, but how good people are at getting it out, and that really has an impact on price. So it's the creativity of people in scholarly publishing that is going to lead us to an additive marketplace, is your view.
Yes, and what people always lose sight of is they think that the product you're selling is the article. They think the product you're selling is the book. They think that the product you're selling is a barrel of oil. You know, the product you're selling is the human imagination. Now, I don't mean to sound highfalutin about this, but it's a question of who figures out where market is going to be, how you can find demand for products and services, and how to deliver these things efficiently. I'm sure that nobody really anticipated 50 years ago that the scholarly publishing market is going to look the way it does today. And the reason it looks the way it does today is because a lot of people put their creative minds together collectively and started to invent an industry. So I think this is the part that's always lost in this discussion, which is that people are not passive. You know, they're creative. Some people are more creative than others, certainly. But without question, the value that's being created in publishing is something that is a function of the kinds of thinking that people bring to publishing. And I guess I just have to say I'm an optimist. I think that this is a growth business if you have the right creative people taking the lead.
Right. And of course, the thing that we're talking about being creative around is the use of technology. Technology made open access possible in the first place, and it seems a reasonable prediction that technology is going to be the important factor in growing this market in the future.
I would say it's the creative interaction of technology with content. The people are going to find new ways of teasing out value. Nobody knew what Mendeley could mean until Mendeley existed. It takes Mendeley to make us understand the implications of file sharing and community-based communications in the world of scholarly communications. It sometimes takes the entrepreneur to make us see that. Yes, it's technology, but it's the human creativity applied to that technology and intersecting with content that makes the difference. Again, this sounds a little bit abstract, but when you actually look at all the new services we have today and say, well, where were these 10 years ago? It's just astonishing how many new things there are.
Well, indeed it is, and we will watch you and your post in the Scholarly Kitchen blog, Joe, to learn more about it in the coming weeks and months. Joe Esposito of Process Media, thanks so much for joining us. And Joe will be back in our question section, but right now we want to turn to Richard Wynn, who's been a guest in the past on these webinars, and Richard Wynn is Vice President for Sales and Marketing of Aries System. Richard, welcome.
Good morning, Chris. Well, thank you.
Yes, indeed. Well, welcome, and it's good to see you again. He's joining us here in our offices in Danvers, near Boston, Massachusetts. And Richard Wynn, apart from being Vice President at Aries, is a scholarly publishing veteran over the last 30 years. And Aries has been a partner of Copyright Clearance Centers now since June 2013, announced, as I recall, at the SSP conference. So there's a bit of an SSP theme to some of this here, Richard. And we'll give you an opportunity to tell people about Aries, and there we have the the information for people to sort of follow along as you tell us briefly about what it is that ARIES does.
Yes, well, we've been involved in scholarly workflow for many years. We launched a online peer review system in 2001. It's now used by over 6,000 journals, and several of the leading scholarly publishers, as well as scholarly open access publishers such as PLOS and BMC. Most of our work, Chris, has been in that workflow area. So editorial manager is used for manuscript submission and peer review, and a companion product called production manager is used downstream to manage the composition and delivery of manuscripts to hosting platforms such as Highwire or Atapon, where they're eventually consumed by readers, libraries, and institutions. The key point I wanted to make on this slide, though, is that historically the processes that we're showing on this slide, the workflow, has been isolated from the business model. So subscriptions happened outside of this in the past. And the big change which has happened with OA is that the commercial interactions have moved into the workflow. And that's caused a lot of stress in scholarly publishers, because their back-end infrastructure was really organized around doing subscriptions later or before, but not processing fees and collecting revenue integrated with the workflow.
Right, and I think that's a good place to refer back to what Joe Esposito was saying, Richard. It's all really about the evolution of the business of scholarly publishing and how the business is evolving to accommodate open access right now, this move from subscription to article processing charges, the so-called APCs, is, as you say, really revolutionary in that respect. It's changing everything. And your point on the slide here is that these interaction points are in the chain, not after. And so solutions and the ways of managing the challenges of it have to occur within that supply chain.
Yes. And actually, I have a little bit of a story to tell about that. A long time ago in publisher land, the king, in other words, the government and the funding baron said there shall be open access. And this came down from on high. And Prince Commercial, that you can see here, who worked for scholarly publishers, initially was very cross about that and said, I'm happy doing subscriptions. Why are you asking me to do OA? So he went into a sulk for a while.
As princes do from time to time.
Right. And but after that, he kind of got over it and said, well, open access isn't really a problem. In fact, it's an opportunity for me. I'm going to start charging APCs. So his first port of call was his accounting department with the enchanting accountarella. And he said, I'd like to process APCs. She pretty much threw him out of the office, but eventually let him back in. And the trouble is that publisher accounting departments are used to dealing with large payments from institutions and subscription agents and really had no idea how to deal with these individual one-off payments from authors. They both also had to talk to Princess Flo, who ran the back office workflow systems for publishers to process these fees. And Princess Flo said, I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm used to doing editorial work, to doing composition work. Why are you talking to me about collecting money? So they had a lot of interesting and interactive conversations, which eventually resulted in the first generation payment systems, which were organized around the idea of collecting one fee from an author, typically by credit card.
Right. Well, we are speaking right now with Richard Wynn. He's the vice president for ARIES, and we're looking at the business and the evolution of open access publishing. If you have a question for Richard Wynn or for our previous guest, Joe Esposito, please use the chat box in the lower right corner of the screen. Let us know what's on your mind, and we'll try to get to as many of those questions at the end of the program as we can. If you're tweeting, the hashtag is hashtag CCC open access. And so Richard, you know, this first generation AP system was launched with great fanfare, but how did it go?
Well, I think in many cases it served the needs of publishers, but I think reality then hit, and we ran into a number of complications in publishers, in that we discovered that APC processing was not so easy. Authors required discounts for different countries. There was a need to set up institutional arrangements, memberships, discounts for society members. We ran into mandates for depositing manuscripts, different tax systems all over the world, the need to charge in different currencies, the need to maybe apply different licenses based on funding rules. So what initially appeared to be a fairy tale story of just processing one-off fees in a very simple way suddenly ran into a lot of gremlins.
Right. Well, and indeed, that's really parallels what the message of Joe Esposito's introductory remarks were, Richard. Is this is a business, and these are the kinds of problems that happen in a business setting.
Absolutely. And every problem is an opportunity for someone else. The need really is for a set of solution requirements that process APCs at low transactional costs, that from a point of view of a publisher are centrally managed so that they have a dashboard where they can manage their open access activity, which are editor blind. In other words, publishers need to avoid potential accusations of bias towards manuscripts which are being paid for, especially in a hybrid environment. Solutions which are scalable to deal with large numbers of transactions are easy to modify. In other words, parameter-driven. You don't need to write new code every time. And are centrally managed from the funder's point of view, because funders and institutions such as libraries, they don't want to have to deal with many different publisher systems either. So they have the mirror reflection of this problem. So as I said, everyone's problem is someone else's opportunity, and we've collaborated to develop an API with CCC and others that allows the workflow systems to interface with APC processing. And we don't have time today, Chris, obviously, to go into that in detail, but I think the deliverables from this innovation is that the king and the funding barons get efficient processing of APCs. The accounting departments, Accounterella in publishers, can go back to processing fairly large transactions, not having to do lots of small granular transactions. Princecom can innovate and create new business models which are parameter driven. So, for example, offering a discount to people who are already subscribers, for example, in a parameter driven model enabled by an API, those sorts of opportunities become accessible. And it also shields the editorial and production workflow in publishers to focus on their business, and pulls out the transaction management to other areas where it can be managed more efficiently.
Right. And so, Richard, that API is a kind of a magic wand, which is always important in a good fairy tale, because we want a happy ending. We really expect a happy ending. And I suppose the other part of a fairy tale is that there's a lesson to be learned here in what to do and what not to do. And so tell us from your perspective at Aries, just what the moral of this particular fairy tale with Accounterella and the others is.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm not sure how far we want to push the analogy, but I think the key takeaway items are that APCs really are not that simple. There's billing, there's credit cards, there's taxes, there's currencies, there's discounts based on country, institutional arrangements where you have maybe prepaid accounts for certain institutions or discounts for members of societies. There are multi-author payment schemes. And on the other side of this, institutions want an efficient process as well. There was a report that came out in the UK last week that estimated the cost on the institutional side of processing an APC, and it comes out to about $150 per APC. That's not the published cost. That's the actual transactional cost on the other side. And clearly, we, as an industry, we need to drive that down so that there's more efficiency throughout.
All right. Well, indeed, I appreciate your telling us that interesting story, Richard Wynn, who is the Vice President of Sales and Marketing at Aries Systems. And now, before we go to the questions from our audience, I want to turn to my own colleague here at Copyright Clearance Center, Chuck Hemingway. Chuck, welcome.
Hi.
Chuck is just back here at Copyright Clearance Center from joining many of you, I would expect, on the call at a special conference. STM holds an annual conference in London at the end of the year. And this year, Chuck, they added a day's worth of programming that they called Beyond Open Access. And you attended along with our other colleague, Bill O'Brien, who spoke. And I think one of the things that was interesting about the characterization of that program and of interest to everybody listening to us right now is that programming information about open access really is evolving, just as the story is, as Joe and Richard have told it. We're moving beyond the debate about gold, green, and all the rest of it, and looking at this as a business and how people can improve the way they do business as scholarly publishers. Tell us briefly what that day's worth of programming was like for you.
Actually, it was very interesting, I think, in the fact that it was very much data-centric. So much to some folks' dismay, there was a lot of talk about data, data treatments, metadata, all of the things that have been very hot topics in the last 2 years. But it just goes to show, I think, that these are the things, this is the housekeeping, you know, that needs to be done in order for folks to go forth and experiment with their models and embrace the author as a customer and strengthen the relationship with the institutions, which they're, you know, everyone is trying to do. And in order to do that, you know, they have to break through this layer of housekeeping, technology housekeeping, which includes getting starting to acquire the right kinds of metadata, institutional identifiers, FundRef identifiers, ORCID IDs. These are the things that are now necessary in order to scale, in order to have flexibility and have reliability and predictability from any solution.
Right, and of course, you know, a conference, an STM conference, is going to attract some of the largest publishers in the world, obviously, and I guess that underscores the point Joe Esposito was making. Things have changed. A few years ago, perhaps there would have been some disquiet in the room, worried about whether or not open access was, as Joe said, going to be a subtractive force, was going to shrink the business. Now people are really seeing opportunity here, as Richard says.
Truly, and I think the numbers and the market will continue to evolve and clear. I think it's you know, much like kicking up silt in the river, right? Sooner or later, it you can see the bottom again. But the immediate output, the immediate byproduct, has been that publishers have seen the need to go out and create better relationships with their suppliers, basically. The numbers don't lie. The institutional segment of the market is providing, at a minimum, 20% of the content. So it's crystallized in the publishers' minds that, business models aside, it would behoove them to go out and strengthen those ties to institutions and to authors, and the numbers will likely shake themselves out.
Sure. Well, at Copyright Clearance Center, we like to say when it comes to open access, we hear you, and so some of the things that we've been doing to evolve our RightsLink offering for open access is in response to the kinds of things you hear and Bill O'Brien hears and our other colleagues here attending these kinds of conferences, meeting with clients. So tell us briefly about the aspects of open access that really are responsive to this.
Well,
RightsLink for open access.
Sure. I think the key, the answer to that question, it could take about an hour, but
you only have 5 minutes, Jeff.
In the interest of everybody's time, I'll say that the key to the solution is the fact that it's iterative and the fact that it's built upon collaboration with publishers. We're constantly reshuffling priorities to meet the demands of the market. Some of the things that will be coming along very quickly are things like, actually, we're just launching a Ringgold ID integration, PCI 3.0 compliance. So these are the types of things that we're doing collectively that allow the publishers to avoid doing them individually. And I would put out a call to action for the folks listening. If they're struggling with managing this part of their program, or they're thinking about building up their open access program, don't go it alone. This is one of the, this payment stuff is something that is going to be much easily done in the collective rather than individually. And CCC's collaboration with great partners like Ares has basically put turnkey solutions at their fingertips so that they don't have to deal with the nuts and bolts, PCI compliance and VAT compliance, that they can spend that time engaging the author, engaging the institution, doing the things that really matter to the business, and avoiding this housekeeping stuff.
Right, and doing that creative work that,
exactly.
that Joe Esposito spoke about.
And we invite them in. There's lots more to come, but it requires good open collaboration with publishers, and we want them involved. We want them to have this seat at the table so that we can build the solution that will serve them.
Great. Well, Chuck Hemingway at Copyright Clearance Center, thank you so much for that. Indeed, you mentioned people having a seat at the table. They have a seat at our webinar today, and they have some questions for us using that chat box in the right-hand corner of the screen. We'll have a look at those and try to get to as many of those as we can. We'll bring Joe Esposito back to the program. All of you, if you do have a question for anyone, if it's in particular for Joe or for Richard, try to let us know. If you are tweeting the program, our hashtag again is hashtag CCC Open Access, and you can follow us on Twitter at Copyright Clear. And Joe Esposito, there have been some questions about the numbers, and you know, you weren't the author of that Simba report, but you read it very closely, and I think the questions point to something you spoke to broadly, which is the real numbers, a real clear picture that is difficult to come by because so much is hidden. There really is a lot behind the screen, and so the questions that are being asked here by some folks are about so-called back content of articles that have been put online with free access. But I don't think that's really what's covered in the Simba numbers, is it? And likewise, I don't think that they did much measurement around these so-called predatory OA publishers, which is, I guess, the bane of OA everywhere.
Well, it's not only the bane of OA, it's the bane of publishing in general. It's the bane of the academic pursuit. You know, the predatory publishers are bad for everybody. The Simba report was pretty clear that there's some information that you can look for, you can track, and some you can't. The thing that they were trying to do, at least my understanding of what they were trying to do, is they were trying to say, is what's the market? Now, if you have somebody who is putting articles up at no cost, and there's no transaction that's involved, no article processing charge or anything else, well, where is the market? So quite rightly, that does not belong in the report. What the report is essentially doing is establishing the fact that you, in fact, have a significant and growing open access market, which now constitutes 2.3% of the total market for journals publishing. And the hidden stuff, you know, the stuff that's on an author, that's attached to an author's blog or a university institutional repository or something like that, doesn't represent the market because nobody's paying anything for it.
Well, indeed. Well, there was a question, Richard Wynn. I think you have some insights on. People, a listener was asking about how common discounts are. I guess that would be related to people who are members of various societies and all kinds of other modifications to a standard charge.
Yeah, I think the question was, how common are APC discounts to subscribers? So really the model we're talking about here is where a publisher says to a university, say, that has a subscription, as part of your subscription, you can receive a certain number of APCs or APC discounts. The innovators in this area was the Royal Society for Chemistry in the UK. They have a program called Gold for Gold, which essentially gives a certain number of APCs to an institution that's a subscriber. And this is potentially a way for publishers to manage the transition from subscription to a higher percentage of APCs. And I believe that program's been very successful and is being copied elsewhere. I also wanted to respond to the other question about the smaller journal potentially using a system like Editorial Manager. And of course, we're very happy to talk to anyone, and I would suggest an offline contact on that question.
Well, indeed. Someone was asking about sort of moving new journals into APC collection. I bet that's a question on a lot of people's minds, whether they have Editorial Manager or not. And so, Richard, I was asking Chuck about the conversations that he has with publishers, and to the point that Joe has made about the evolution of this marketplace, we are seeing publishers who may still stick to some of the tried and true methods, but really want to look at the opportunity of APCs. So it's not, replacing their business, but adding to it. And they must have a lot of really basic questions about how APC collection is going to change the entire workflow.
Yeah, I'd like to reinforce a point that Chuck made, which is that without standards, none of this works. And that would also apply to APCs as well as the evolution of the regular subscription and hybrid models. So we're very fortunate to be living at a time where standards like ORCID and FundRef and institutional identifiers like Ringgold and standardized communication formats such as JAT are available, because this allows us to build software solutions that talk to each other in a standardized way. And I think publishers should absolutely be adopting those standards as fast as they can.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Richard. There's a question from Susan here, which is sort of getting into that crystal ball frame of mind. And Joe, she's asking about the possibility of open access completely overtaking subscriptions as a business model. It sounds to me like you feel that this is going to be not in place of, but alongside of. So we will never actually see subscriptions vanish from the scene. In fact, we'll expect to see them both living side by side for some time to come.
Well, I have to say that I'm a pluralist. I think that you can have them living side by side for some time to come. The argument for substitution, which is what Susan is talking about, I think is really belied by the facts, which the facts are that libraries have money to spend, and they seem to want to spend it. And although there is some movement, as Richard pointed out, to use some of these monies in order to pay for article processing charges, I just don't really see in any reasonable period of time, let's say 3 or 5 years, I just don't see the librarians saying to their provosts, we don't need to have a materials budget anymore. Everything is open access. I just don't see that happening. And I think this gets us to yet another one of these strange paradoxes of scholarly communications, and that is that the large commercial publishers and the librarians are in a kind of an unholy embrace. That is that the publishers need somebody to pay for their toll access publications, and libraries are in the business, among other things, of paying for toll access publications. So until somebody can break up that particular institutional romance, I really don't see the toll access publications going away.
Oh, indeed. Well, you know, we have, as we sit at the top of the hour here, attracted a very broad audience from around the world. And so we're getting some questions that really are philosophical as much as they are about the business. And we have a question from Tomas here, which is regarding Green OA, the so-called repositories. And as you mentioned, not a factor in measuring the size of the business because there's no revenue associated with them. And Thomas goes even further to ask how useful those will be in the future. Are they, as he characterizes it, a waste of time and money? Joe, do you have any thoughts on that?
That language is a lot stronger than anything I would personally want to use. What I would say is basically this. Green OA requires the existence of a parallel world of toll access publications. The toll access publications absorb all of the costs, do all of the editorial management, do all the create all the licenses with vendors such as Aries Systems and so forth. And the Greenaway then kind of sits outside of that in a parallel universe. Now, all of that is well and good unless people start to say that the Greenaway is a substitute for those toll access publications. So Greenaway really is something that essentially undermines the ability to create all that editorial material in a proper, formal, peer-reviewed way. So I really don't see it as being a useful way to pursue open access or to pursue publishing at all. I think that the gold OA model is a better path. But I want to be very clear. I'm agnostic as to this. I don't really have any stake in one thing happening or another. What I'm interested in is what's going to happen and how somebody can then jump on that and make it happen in a better way.
Well, indeed. Well, thank you for that insight. And again, that's why we turn to Joe Esposito and Scholarly Kitchen blog as frequently as we do. And Joe Esposito, thank you. Let's just wrap things up here for our program today. We'll remind you that in partnership with the Association of Learned and Professional Society Publishers, Copyright Clearance Center maintains a resource online for all information or for information of all kinds about open access. That's at openaccessresources.org. You get the latest OA news reports, white papers, news about webinars like this one. It's broken down by region, so if you want to follow the news from your particular corner of the world, Asia, the Middle East, Pacific, Americas, and the UK and Europe, you can do that as well. And so we do hope you'll bookmark openaccessresources.org and check that out as frequently as you think you should. And with that, we'll wrap things up here. We appreciate your questions, your tweets. I want to thank for joining us today Joe Esposito, the president of Process Media. Joe, thanks so much.
You're quite welcome, and thank you for having me.
Richard Wynn, vice president of sales and marketing at Aries Systems, down the road from us here at Copyright Clearance Center. Thanks for coming in today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
And Chuck Hemingway, director of business development, my colleague here at Copyright Clearance Center. Thank you.
Always a good time.
My name is Chris Keneally. For everybody at Copyright Clearance Center, and on behalf of T.C. Bassett, who kept the slides running and the technology in order today, I want to thank you for joining us. Much more about what we do at Copyright Clearance Center and our rights link for open access solution at copyright.com/openaccess. Thanks again, and have a great day.